Chapter 26 Water Rises Too. 7 days later, the Buddha was happy to find himself back in the forest of the Bodhi tree. He rested the night there. In the morning, he surprised Svasti by the banks of the Niranjara River. They sat for a long while along the shore before the Buddha told Svasti he should continue cutting the kusa grass needed by the buffaloes. He also helped Svasti cut some grass. Then, bidding Svasti goodbye, he walked to the village to beg. The next afternoon, the village children came to visit the Buddha in the forest. All of Svasti's family was there. Sujata brought along her friends. The children were very happy to see the Buddha again. They listened intently while he told them all that had happened to him in the past year. The Buddha promised Svasti that when Svasti was 20 years old, the Buddha would accept him as a bhikkhu. By that time, Svasti's sisters and brothers would be old enough to care for themselves. The children told the Buddha that over the past few months, a spiritual community led by a Brahmin had settled nearby. There were 500 devotees in all. They did not shave their heads like the bhikkhus. Instead, their hair was braided and then piled on top of their heads. They worshipped the god of fire. The Brahmin's name was Kassapa. He was deeply revered by all who met him. The following morning, the Buddha crossed the river and found Master Kassapa's community. His devotees lived in simple huts made from leafy branches and wore clothes made from the bark of trees. They did not enter the village to beg, but accepted offerings brought to them by the villagers. In addition, they raised their own animals for food and for making sacrifices. The Buddha stopped to speak with one of Kassapa's followers, who told him that Kassapa was deeply versed in the Vedas and lived a life of utmost virtue. Kassapa, he explained, also had two younger brothers who also led communities of fire worship. All three brothers held fire to be the original essence of the universe. Uruvela Kassapa was deeply loved by his two brothers, Nadi Kassapa, who lived with 300 devotees along the Niranjara about a day's travel north, and Gaya Kassapa, who led 200 devotees in Gaya. Kassapa's disciple led the Buddha to his master's hut so that the Buddha could have an audience with him. Although Kassapa was no longer a young man, he was still quick and alert. When he saw the young teacher's extraordinary bearing, he felt immediately drawn to him and treated him as a special guest. Kassapa invited the Buddha to sit on a stump outside the hut, and the two enjoyed a long conversation. Kassapa marveled at how deeply versed the Buddha was in the Vedas. He was further astounded to discover that this young monk had grasped certain concepts in the Vedas that had eluded his own understanding. The Buddha helped explain certain of the most profound passages in the Atharveda and Rigveda scriptures that Kassapa thought he had understood, but discovered he had not yet truly grasped. Even more amazing was the young monk's knowledge of history, doctrine, and Brahmanic rituals. That noon, the Buddha accepted Uruvela Kassapa's invitation to have a meal with him. The Buddha neatly folded his outer robe into a cushion and sat upon it, eating in mindful silence. So impressed was Uruvela Kassapa by the Buddha's serene and majestic countenance that he did not break the silence. That afternoon, they continued their conversation. The Buddha asked, "Master Kassapa, can you explain to me how worshipping fire can lead a person to liberation?" Uruvela Kassapa did not answer right away. He knew very well that a superficial or ordinary response would not suffice for this extraordinary young monk. Kassapa began by explaining that fire was the basic essence of the universe. It had its source in Brahma. The main altar of the community, the fire sanctuary, always kept a sacred fire burning. That fire was itself the image of Brahma. The Atharveda scripture spoke of fire worship. Fire was life. Without fire, there could be no life. Fire was light, warmth, and the source of the sun, which enabled plants, animals, and people to live. It chased away dark shadows, conquered the cold, and brought joy and vitality to all beings. Food was made edible by fire, and thanks to fire, people were reunited with Brahma at death. Because fire was the source of life, it was Brahma himself. Agni, the god of fire, was one of the thousands of manifestations of Brahma. On the fire altar, Agni was portrayed as having two heads. One symbolized the daily uses of fire, and the others symbolize the fire of sacrifice and returning to the source of life. The fire worshippers performed 40 sacrificial rites. A devotee in their community had to observe precepts, practice austerities, and pray diligently in order to follow the path that would one day lead to liberation. Kassapa was strongly opposed to those Brahmins who used their position in society to acquire wealth and lose themselves in pursuit of sensual pleasures. He said that such Brahmins only performed rituals and recited the scriptures in order to become rich. Because of that, the reputation of the traditional Brahmanic path had become tarnished. The Buddha asked, "Master Kassapa, what do you think of those who regard water as the fundamental essence of life, who say that water is the element that purifies and returns people to union with Brahma?" Kassapa hesitated. He thought of the hundreds of thousands of people, right at that very moment, who were bathing themselves in the waters of Ganga and other sacred rivers to purify themselves. "Gautama, water cannot really help one attain liberation. Water naturally flows down. Only fire rises. When we die, our body rises in smoke thanks to fire." "Master Kassapa, that is not accurate. The white clouds floating above are also a form of water. Thus, water rises too. Indeed, smoke itself is no more than evaporated water. Both clouds and smoke will eventually return to a liquid state. All things, as I'm sure you know, move in cycles. But all things share one fundamental essence, and all things return to that one essence. Master Kassapa, all things depend on all other things for their existence. Take, for example, this leaf in my hand. Earth, water, heat, seed, tree, clouds, sun, time, space. All these elements have enabled this leaf to come into existence. If just one of these elements was missing, the leaf could not exist. All beings, organic and inorganic, rely on the law of dependent co-arising. The source of one thing is all things. Please consider this carefully. Don't you see that this leaf I am now holding in my hand is only here thanks to the interpenetration of all the phenomena in the universe, including your own awareness?" It was already evening and beginning to grow dark. Kassapa invited the Buddha to sleep in his own hut. It was the first time he had ever made such an offer to anyone. But then he had never before met such an extraordinary monk. But the Buddha refused, saying that he had grown accustomed to sleeping alone at night. He said he would like to sleep in the fire sanctuary, if that would be all right. The Brahmin said, "For the past several days, an enormous snake has taken refuge in the fire sanctuary. All efforts to chase it away have failed. You must not sleep there, friend Gautama. It might be dangerous. We have even been holding our ceremonies outside for fear of the snake. Please, sleep in my hut for your own safety." The Buddha replied, "Don't worry. I want to sleep in the fire sanctuary. I will not be in any danger." The Buddha recalled all the months he had practiced austerities in the wild jungles. Wild beasts passed him by without harming him. Sometimes, while he sat in meditation, enormous snakes slithered in front of him. He knew that if you took care not to frighten such animals, they would not harm you. Seeing that the Buddha could not be dissuaded, Kassapa said, "If you wish to sleep in the fire sanctuary, you shall. You may sleep there as many nights as you like." That night, the Buddha entered the fire sanctuary. On the central altar burned a great fire fed by many candles. On one side of the room was a pile of sandalwood logs, which were used for outdoor ceremonies. The Buddha guessed that the snake was probably curled up in the wood pile, so he sat in meditation on the other side of the room, using his folded robe as a cushion. He meditated deep into the night. Toward the end of his meditation, he saw the great snake coiled in the center of the room looking at him. The Buddha spoke softly to it. "Dear friend, return to the jungle for your own safety." The Buddha's voice was filled with love and understanding. The snake slowly uncoiled itself and crept out the door. The Buddha stretched out and fell asleep. When he awoke, brilliant moonlight poured through the window onto his sleeping place. The 18th day moon was unusually bright. He thought how pleasant it would be to do walking meditation beneath its light. He shook off the dust from his outer robe and put it on before walking out of the fire sanctuary. In the early hours of the morning, the sanctuary somehow caught on fire. Those who saw it first shouted to all the others. Everyone filled buckets with water at the river's edge, but to no avail. The water came too late to extinguish the raging fire. At last, the 500 devotees could do no more than stand and watch their sanctuary burn to the ground. Uruvela Kassapa stood with his followers. His heart was heavy with grief as he thought of the virtuous and talented young monk he had met only the day before. The young monk had surely perished in the fire. If only Gautama had consented to sleep in his hut, he would still be alive. Just as he was thinking this, the Buddha appeared. The Buddha had seen the fire from where he had been walking in the hills, and he had returned to see if he could be of any assistance. Overcome with relief and joy, Kassapa ran to the Buddha and grasped his hand. "Thank goodness you are alive, friend Gautama! Nothing has happened to you! I am so happy!" The Buddha placed his hands on the Brahmin's shoulders and smiled. "Thank you, my friend. Yes, I am all right." The Buddha knew that on that day Uruvela Kassapa would give a discourse, and that in addition to his own 500 disciples, at least 1,000 others would attend from the neighboring villages. The lecture would take place after the noon meal. Sensing that his presence during the lecture might cause Kassapa some discomfort, the Buddha went begging down in the village. After receiving food offerings, he walked to the lotus pond, ate his meal there, and spent the entire afternoon at that pleasant place. Late in the afternoon, Kassapa came looking for him. When he found him by the pond, he said, "Friend Gautama, we waited for you at the noon meal, but you never appeared. Why didn't you join us?" The Buddha responded that he had wished to be absent during the lecture. "Why did you not wish to attend the lecture?" asked Uruvela Kassapa. The Buddha only smiled gently. The Brahmin did not say anything else. He knew that the young monk had read his thoughts. How tactful and considerate Gautama was! They sat by the lotus pond and conversed. Kassapa said, "Yesterday you said that the presence of a leaf resulted from the coming together of many different conditions. You said that humans, too, exist only because of the coming together of many other conditions. But when all these conditions cease to be, where does the self go?" The Buddha answered, "For a long time humans have been trapped by the concept of Atman, the concept of a separate and eternal self. We have believed that when our body dies, this self continues to exist and seeks union with its source, which is Brahma. But friend Kassapa, that is a fundamental misunderstanding, which has caused countless generations to go astray. You should know, friend Kassapa, that all things exist because of interdependence, and all things cease to be because of interdependence. This is because that is. This is not because that is not. This is born because that is born. This dies because that dies. This is the wonderful law of dependent co-arising, which I have discovered in my meditation. In truth, there is nothing that is separate and eternal. There is no self, whether a higher or a lower self. Kassapa, have you ever meditated on your body, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness? A person is made up of these five aggregates. They are continuously changing rivers in which one cannot find even one permanent element." Uruvela Kassapa remained silent for a long moment. Then he asked, "Could one say, then, that you teach the doctrine of non-being?" The Buddha smiled and shook his head. "No. The concept of non-being is one narrow view among a whole forest of narrow views. The concept of non-being is just as false as the concept of a separate, permanent self. Kassapa, look at the surface of this lotus pond. I do not say that the water and lotus do not exist. I only say that the water and the lotus arise thanks to the presence and interpenetration of all other elements, none of which are separate or permanent." Kassapa lifted his head and looked into the Buddha's eyes. "If there is no self, no Atman, why should one practice a spiritual path in order to attain liberation? Who will be liberated?" The Buddha looked deeply into the eyes of his Brahmana friend. His gaze was as radiant as the sun and as gentle as the soft moonlight. He smiled and said, "Kassapa, look for the answer within yourself." They returned together to Kassapa's community. Uruvela Kassapa insisted on giving the Buddha his hut for the night, and and went to sleep himself in the hut of one of his senior disciples. The Buddha could see how deeply Kassapa's disciples revered their teacher. Chapter 27. All Dharmas Are on Fire. Every morning Kassapa brought the Buddha some food, and so the Buddha did not need to go begging in the village. After his daily meal, he walked alone on forest paths or down to the lotus pond. In the later afternoons, Kassapa would join him for discussion beneath the trees or beside the pond. The more time he spent with the Buddha, the more Kassapa understood how wise and virtuous the Buddha was. One night it rained so heavily that by morning the Niranjara River had overflowed its banks. Nearby fields and dwellings were quickly submerged by floodwaters. Desperate villagers took boats out to try to rescue people. Kassapa's community was able to climb to higher land in time, but no one could find Gautama. Kassapa sent several boats to look for him. At last he was found standing on a distant hill. The water subsided as quickly as it had risen. The next morning the Buddha took his begging bowl and went down into the village to see how the villagers had fared in the flood. Luckily, no one had drowned. The people told the Buddha that because they did not own many possessions in the first place, the flood had not robbed them of much. Kassapa's disciples began to rebuild the fire sanctuary, which had been destroyed by fire, and to rebuild their huts washed away by the flood. One afternoon, while the Buddha and Kassapa stood along the banks of the Niranjara, Kassapa said, "Gautama, the other day you spoke about the meditation on one's body, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness. I have been practicing that meditation, and I have begun to understand how one's feelings and perceptions determine the quality of one's life. I also see that there is no permanent element to be found in any of the five rivers. I can even see that the belief in a separate self is false. But I still don't understand why one should follow a spiritual path if there is no self. Who is there to be liberated?" The Buddha asked, "Kassapa, do you accept that suffering is a truth?" "Yes, Gautama, I accept that suffering is a truth." "Do you agree that suffering has causes?" "Yes, I accept that suffering has causes." "Kassapa, when the causes of suffering are present, suffering is present. When the causes of suffering are removed, suffering is also removed." "Yes, I see that when the causes of suffering are removed, suffering itself is removed." "The cause of suffering is ignorance, a false way of looking at reality. Thinking the impermanent is permanent, that is ignorance. Thinking there is a self when there is not, that is ignorance. From ignorance is born greed, anger, fear, jealousy, and countless other sufferings. The path of liberation is the path of looking deeply at things in order to truly realize the nature of impermanence, the absence of a separate self, and the interdependence of all things. This path is the path that overcomes ignorance. Once ignorance is overcome, suffering is transcended. That is true liberation. There is no need for a self for there to be liberation." Uruvela Kassapa sat silently for a moment and then said, "Gautama, I know you speak only from your own direct experience. Your words do not simply express concepts. You have said that liberation can only be attained through the efforts of meditation, by looking deeply at things. Do you think that all ceremonies, rituals, and prayers are useless?" The Buddha pointed to the other side of the river and said, "Kassapa, if a person wants to cross to the other shore, what should he do?" "If the water is shallow enough, he can wade across. Otherwise, he will have to swim or row a boat across." "I agree. But what if he is unwilling to wade, swim, or row a boat? What if he just stands on this side of the river and prays to be on the other shore to come to him? What would you think of such a man?"
"I would say he was being quite foolish."
"Just so, Kassapa. If one doesn't overcome ignorance and mental obstructions, one cannot cross to the other side to liberation, even if one spends one's whole life praying." Suddenly, Kassapa burst into tears and prostrated himself before the Buddha's feet. "Gautama, I have wasted more than half my life. Please accept me as your disciple and give me the chance to study and practice the way of liberation with you." The Buddha helped Kassapa stand back up and said, "I would not hesitate to accept you as my disciple, but what of your 500 devotees? Who will guide them if you leave?" Kassapa answered, "Gautama, give me a chance to speak with them this morning. Tomorrow afternoon I will let you know of my decision." the Buddha said. The children in Uruvela village call me the Buddha.
Kasapa was surprised. That means the awakened one, doesn't it? I will call you the same.
The next morning, the Buddha went begging in Uruvela village. Afterward, he went to the lotus pond to sit. Late that afternoon, Kasapa came looking for him. He told the Buddha that all 500 of his devotees agreed to become disciples under the Buddha's guidance. The next day, Uruvela Kasapa and all his followers shaved their heads and beards and threw the locks of hair into the Naranjara River, along with all the liturgical objects they had used for fire worship. They bowed before the Buddha and recited three times, I take refuge in the Buddha, the one who shows me the way in this life. I take refuge in the Dharma, the way of understanding and love. I take refuge in the Sangha, the community that lives in harmony and awareness. The recitation of the three refuges echoed throughout the forest. When the ordination was completed, the Buddha spoke to the new bhikkhus about the Four Noble Truths and how to observe one's breath, body, and mind. He showed them how to beg for food and how to eat in silence. He asked them to release all the animals they had once raised for food and sacrifices. That afternoon, the Buddha met with Kasapa and 10 of Kasapa's senior students to teach them the fundamentals of the Way of Awakening, as well as to discuss how to best organize the Sangha. Kasapa was a talented organizer and leader, and with the Buddha, he assigned capable senior students to train the younger bhikkhus, just as the Buddha had done in Isipatana. The next day, Nadi Kasapa, Uruvela Kasapa's younger brother, arrived with his disciples in a state of shock. The day before, he and his 300 devotees who lived downstream from Uruvela had seen hundreds of braids and liturgical objects floating in the river, and they feared some terrible catastrophe had befallen the community of his elder brother. When Nadi Kasapa reached Uruvela, it was the hour of begging, and so he was unable to find anyone. His worst fears seemed to be confirmed. But slowly, bhikkhus began to return from begging, and they explained how they had all taken vows to follow a monk named Gautama. Uruvela Kasapa returned from begging with the Buddha and was most happy to see his younger brother. He invited him for a walk in the forest. They were gone for a good length of time, and when they returned, Nadi Kasapa announced that he and his 300 devotees would also take refuge in the Buddha. Both brothers agreed to send someone to summon their brother Gaya Kasapa. Thus, in the space of only 7 days, the 200 devotees of Gaya Kasapa were also ordained as bhikkhus. The Kasapa brothers were well known for their brotherly love and sharing of common ideals. Together, they became deeply devoted students of the Buddha. One day, after all the bhikkhus had returned from begging, the Buddha summoned them to gather on the slopes of the mountain in Gaya. 900 bhikkhus ate in silence with the Buddha and the three Kasapa brothers. When they were finished eating, they all turned their gaze to the Buddha. Sitting serenely upon a large rock, the Buddha began to speak. Bhikkhus, all dharmas are on fire. What is on fire? The 6 sense organs, eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, and mind, are all on fire. The 6 objects of the senses, form, sound, smell, taste, touch, and objects of mind, are all on fire. The 6 consciousnesses, sight, hearing, smell, taste, feeling, and thought, are all on fire. They are burning from the flames of desire, hatred, and illusion. They are burning from the flames of birth, old age, sickness, and death, and from the flames of pain, anxiety, frustration, worry, fear, and despair. Bhikkhus, every feeling is burning, whether it is an unpleasant, pleasant, or neutral feeling. Feelings arise and are conditioned by the sense organs, objects of the sense organs, and the sense consciousnesses. Feelings are burning from the flames of desire, hatred, and illusion. Feelings are burning from the flames of birth, old age, sickness, and death, and from the flames of pain, anxiety, frustration, worry, fear, and despair. Bhikkhus, do not allow yourselves to be consumed by the flames of desire, hatred, and illusion. See the impermanent and interdependent nature of all dharmas in order not to be enslaved by the cycle of birth and death created by the sense organs, objects of the senses, and the sense consciousnesses.
900 bhikkhus listened intently. Each man was deeply moved. They were happy to know they had found the path that taught how to look deeply in order to attain liberation. Faith welled in the heart of every bhikkhu there. The Buddha remained in Gayasisa for 3 months to teach the new bhikkhus, and the bhikkhus made great progress. The Kassapa brothers were talented assistants to the Buddha, and they helped him guide and teach the Sangha. Chapter 28 Palm Forest. The morning had arrived for the Buddha to depart from Gayasisa and make his way to Rajagaha. Buruvela Kassapa asked the Buddha to allow the entire Sangha to accompany him. The Buddha was reluctant, but Kassapa explained how easily 900 bhikkhus could travel together. There would be many forests around Rajagaha where the bhikkhus could dwell. They could beg in the many villages there, as well as in the capital city itself, making contact with many local people. Moreover, added Kassapa, the number of bhikkhus was now too large for the population of Gaya to support. Everything would be easier in Rajagaha. Seeing how knowledgeable Uruvela Kassapa was about the situation in Mogoda, the Buddha agreed to let the 900 bhikkhus join him. The Kassapa brothers divided the Sangha into 36 groups of 25 bhikkhus. Each group was led by a senior student. This arrangement allowed the bhikkhus to make ever greater progress on the path. 10 days were needed for them all to reach Rajagaha. Each morning they begged in small villages and ate silently in the forests or fields. When they finished eating, they began to walk again, traveling in their own small groups. The sight of the bhikkhus walking quietly and slowly made a deep impression on all who saw them. When they neared Rajagaha, Uruvela Kassapa led them to Palm Forest, where the Supatita Temple was located. Palm Forest was only 2 miles south of the capital. The next morning, the bhikkhus took their bowls and went begging in the city. They walked single file in their small groups, taking calm, slow steps. They held their bowls serenely while their eyes looked straight ahead. Following the Buddha's instructions, they stood before each house without discriminating whether it belonged to rich or poor. If no one appeared, after a few moments, they moved on to the next house. While silently waiting for food offerings to be made, they mindfully observed their breath. When they received a food offering, they bowed in thanks. They never made any comments about whether the food looked good or bad. Sometimes the layperson making the offering asked the bhikkhu a few questions about the Dharma, and the bhikkhu answered thoughtfully to the best of his ability. The bhikkhu explained that he belonged to the Sangha of Gautama the Buddha. He would speak about the Four Noble Truths, the 5 precepts for the laity, and the Noble Eightfold Path. The bhikkhus always returned to Palm Forest by noon to share their meal in silence before listening to a discourse on the Dharma given by the Buddha. Afternoons and evenings were reserved for meditation practice. Thus, after the noon hour, no one in the city saw the saffron-robed bhikkhus. By the end of 2 weeks, most of the city was aware of the presence of the Buddha Sangha. On cool afternoons, many laypersons came to Palm Forest to meet the Buddha and to learn about the way of awakening. Before the Buddha had had a chance to visit his friend, the young king Sinhiya Bimbisara had already learned of the Buddha's presence. Sure that this new teacher was the same monk he had met on the mountain, he mounted his carriage and ordered it driven to Palm Forest. Many other carriages followed his, for he had invited over 100 highly regarded Brahmana teachers and intellectuals to join him. When they reached the edge of the forest, the king stepped out of his carriage, accompanied by the queen and their son, Prince Ajatasattu. When the Buddha was informed of the king's arrival, he and Uruvela Kassapa personally went out to greet him and all his guests. All the bhikkhus were seated in great circles in the earth, waiting to hear the Buddha's Dharma talk. The Buddha invited the king, queen, prince, and other guests to be seated too. King Bimbisara introduced many of the guests, but sometimes had to ask a Brahmin to introduce himself. Among the guests were many scholars well-versed in the Vedas and belonging to many different schools of religious thought. Most of these men had heard the name of Uruvela Kassapa. A number of them had even met him before, but no one had ever heard of the Buddha. They were surprised to see how reverently Kassapa treated the Buddha, even though Gautama Sakya was so much younger than Kassapa. They whispered to one another, trying to figure out whether Gautama was Kassapa's disciple or Kassapa was Gautama's disciple. Aware of their confusion, Uruvela Kassapa stood up and approached the Buddha. He joined his palms and spoke clearly and with respect, "Gautama, the Enlightened One, most precious teacher in this life, I am Uruvela Kassapa, your disciple. Allow me to offer you my most profound respect." Then he prostrated himself before the Buddha 3 times. The Buddha helped Kassapa stand up again and asked him to sit by his side. There were no more whispers among the Brahmins. Indeed, their respect increased as they looked out over the 900 saffron-robed bhikkhus sitting with awe-inspiring solemnity. The Buddha spoke about the way of awakening. He spoke about the impermanent and interdependent nature of all things in life. He said that the path of awakening could help one overcome false views and transcend suffering. He spoke about how observing the precepts could help one attain concentration and understanding. His voice resounded like a great bell. It was as warm as spring sunshine, as gentle as a light rain, and as majestic as the rising tide. More than 1,000 people listened. No one dared to breathe too loudly or rustle their robes for fear of disturbing the sound of the Buddha's wondrous voice. King Bimbisara's eyes grew brighter by the moment. The more he listened, the more he felt his heart open. So many of his doubts and troubles vanished. A radiant smile appeared on his face. When the Buddha concluded his Dharma talk, King Bimbisara stood up and joined his palms. He said, "Lord, from the time I was young, I had 5 wishes. I have now fulfilled them all. The first wish was to receive coronation and become king. That has been fulfilled. The second wish was to meet in this very life an enlightened teacher. That has also been fulfilled. The third wish was to have a chance to show respect to such a teacher. That wish has now been fulfilled. The fourth wish was to have such a teacher show me the true path. That wish has now been fulfilled. And the fifth wish was to be able to understand the teaching of the Enlightened One. Master, this wish has just been fulfilled. Your wondrous teaching has brought me much understanding. Lord, please accept me as your lay disciple." The Buddha smiled his acceptance. The king invited the Buddha and all 900 of his bhikkhus to have a meal at the palace on the day of the full moon. The Buddha gladly accepted. All the other guests stood up to thank the Buddha. 20 of them expressed the desire to be accepted as the Buddha's disciples. The Buddha and Uruvela Kassapa accompanied the king, queen, and little prince Ajatasattu back to the edge of the forest. The Buddha knew that in less than a month the rainy season would begin, and it would be impossible to return to his homeland. Therefore, he resolved to remain with the 900 bhikkhus in Palm Forest for another 3 months. He knew that after 3 months of practice, the Sangha would be strong and stable enough for him to depart. He would leave in the spring, the season of clear skies and tender new plants. King Saniya Bimbisara began at once to prepare for the reception of the Buddha and his bhikkhus. He planned to serve them in the great palace court paved with fine bricks. He called to his people to deck the streets with lanterns and flowers to welcome the Buddha and his Sangha. He invited a great many other people to attend, including all the members of the government and their families. Children close to the age of 12-year-old Prince Ajatasattu were invited too. Knowing that the Buddha and his bhikkhus did not allow others to kill for their sake, he ordered that only delicious vegetarian foods be prepared. They had 10 days to prepare for the reception. Chapter 29. Dependent Co-Arising. Throughout the following weeks, many seekers came to the Buddha and asked to be ordained as bhikkhus. Many of them were highly educated young men from wealthy families. The Buddha's senior students performed the ordination ceremonies and gave the new bhikkhus basic instruction in the practice. Other young people, women as well as men, came to Palm Forest and took the 3 refuges. One day, Kondana gave the 3 refuges to a gathering of nearly 300 young people. After the ceremony, he spoke to them about the 3 precious gems, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. The Buddha is the awakened one. An awakened person sees the nature of life and the cosmos. Because of that, An awakened person is not bound by illusion, fear, anger, or desire. An awakened person is a free person, filled with peace and joy, love and understanding. Master Gautama, our teacher, is a completely awakened person. He shows us the way in this life so that we may overcome forgetfulness and become awakened ourselves. Every one of us contains Buddha nature. We can all become a Buddha. Buddha nature is the capacity to awaken and transcend all ignorance. If we practice the way of awareness, our Buddha nature will shine more brightly every day until one day we, too, shall attain total freedom, peace, and joy. We must each find the Buddha within our own heart. The Buddha is the first precious gem. The Dharma is the path that leads to awakening. It is the path that the Buddha teaches, the path that helps us to transcend the prisons of ignorance, anger, fear, and desire. This path leads to freedom, peace, and joy. It enables us to love and understand all others. Understanding and love are the two most beautiful fruits of the path of awakening. The Dharma is the second precious gem. The Sangha is the community of persons practicing the way of awakening, those who travel this path together. If you want to practice the way of liberation, it is important to have a community to practice with. If you are all alone, difficulties along the path may hinder your realization of awakening. It is important to take refuge in the Sangha, whether you are an ordained bhikkhu or a layperson. The Sangha is the third precious gem. Young people, today you have taken refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. With the support of these refuges, you will not wander aimlessly, but will be able to make real progress on the path of enlightenment. It has been 2 years since I took refuge in the three gems myself. Today you have vowed to travel the same path. Let us rejoice together that we have taken refuge in the three precious gems. Of course, these gems have been present in our own hearts from beginningless time. Together, we will practice the way of liberation to allow these three gems to shine from within us. The young people were greatly encouraged by Kondana's words. They all felt a new source of vitality surge within their hearts. During these same days, the Buddha received two exceptional new disciples, Sariputta and Moggallana, into his Sangha of bhikkhus. They were both disciples of the famous ascetic Sanjaya, who lived in Rajagaha. Sanjaya's devotees were called Parivrajakas. Sariputta and Moggallana were close friends, respected for their intelligence and open-mindedness. They had promised each other that whoever attained the great way first would immediately inform the other. One day, Sariputta saw the bhikkhu Asaji begging in Rajagaha, and he was immediately drawn by Asaji's relaxed and serene being. Sariputta thought to himself, "This appears to be someone who has attained the way. I knew such persons could be found. I will ask him who his teacher is and what his teaching is." Sariputta quickened his pace to catch up with Asaji, but then stopped himself, not wanting to disturb the bhikkhu while he was silently begging from house to house. Sariputta resolved to wait until Asaji was finished begging before approaching him. Without making himself noticed, Sariputta followed Asaji. When Asaji's bowl was filled with offerings and he turned to leave the city, Sariputta joined his palms in respectful greeting and said, "Monk, you radiate such peace and calm. Your virtue and understanding shine in the way you walk, in the expression on your face, and in your every gesture. Please allow me to ask who your teacher is and at what practice center you reside. What methods does your teacher teach?" Asaji looked at Sariputta for a moment and then smiled in a most friendly manner. He answered, "I study and practice under the guidance of the Master Gautama of the Sakya clan, who is known as the Buddha. He is presently dwelling near Supatita Temple in Palm Forest." Sariputta's eyes brightened. "What is his teaching? Can you share it with me?" "The Buddha's teaching is deep and lovely. I have not grasped it fully yet. You should come and receive the teachings directly from the Buddha." But Sariputta implored Asaji, "Please, can't you share with me in a few words of the Buddha's teaching? It would be so precious to me. I will come for more teaching later." Asaji smiled and then recited a short gatha. "From interdependent origins all things arise and all things pass away. So teaches the perfectly enlightened one." Sariputta suddenly felt his heart open as though it were being flooded by bright light. A flawless glimpse of true Dharma flashed before him. He bowed to Asaji and quickly ran to seek his friend Moggallana. When Moggallana saw Sariputta's radiant face, he asked, "My brother, what has made you so happy? Can you have found the true path? Please tell me, brother." Sariputta related what had just happened. When he recited the gatha for Moggallana to hear, Moggallana also felt a sudden flash of light illuminate his heart and mind. Suddenly he saw the universe as an interconnected net. This was because that was. This arose because that arose. This was not because that was not. This passed away because that passed away. The belief in a creator of all things vanished in this understanding of dependent co-arising. He now understood how one could cut through the endless cycle of birth and death. The door of liberation opened before him. Moggallana said, "Brother, we must go to the Buddha at once. He is the teacher we've been waiting for." Sariputta agreed, but reminded him, "What of the 250 Parivajraka brothers who have long placed their faith and trust in us as elder brothers of the community? We can't just abandon them. We must go and inform them of our decision first." The two friends made their way to the Parivajraka main gathering place and explained to their fellow practitioners their decision to leave the community and become disciples of the Buddha. When the Parivrajakas heard that Sariputta and Moggallana were about to leave them, they were grieved. The community would not be the same without these two elder brothers. And so, they all expressed their desire to follow them and become disciples of the Buddha too. Sariputta and Moggallana went to Master Sanjaya and told him of the decision of the community. He entreated them to stay, saying, "If you remain here, I will transfer the leadership of the community to you both." He said this three times, but Sariputta and Moggallana had made up their minds. They said, "Respected Master, we embarked on the spiritual path in order to find liberation and not to become religious leaders. If we do not know the true path, how can we lead others? We must seek out the Master Gautama, for he has attained the path we have long sought for." Sariputta and Moggallana prostrated themselves before Sanjaya and then departed, followed by the other Parivrajakas. They walked to Palm Forest, where they all prostrated before the Buddha and asked to be ordained. The Buddha spoke to them about the Four Noble Truths and accepted them as bhikkhus in his Sangha. After the ordination ceremony, the number of bhikkhus in Palm Grove numbered 1,250. Here ends Book 1. Book 2. Chapter 30. Bamboo Forest. It was the full moon day. The Buddha took his bowl and entered the city of Rajagaha with his 1,250 bhikkhus. They walked silently with slow, calm steps. The streets of the capital were decorated with lanterns and fresh flowers. Crowds flanked both sides of the streets to welcome the Buddha and his Sangha. When the bhikkhus came to the main crossroads, the crowd was so dense that it was impossible for the Buddha and his bhikkhus to proceed. Uruvela Kasapa was wondering what to do when a handsome young fellow appeared, singing and playing a 16-string sitar. His voice resonated like a clear bell. As he walked through the crowd singing, the people moved to the sides to let him pass. There was now a path for the Buddha and his bhikkhus to continue walking. Kasapa recognized the musician who had taken the three refuges with him less than a month earlier. His song expressed his deep feelings. "On this fresh spring morning, the Enlightened One passes through our city with the noble community of 1,250 disciples. All are walking with slow, calm, and radiant steps." The crowds listened to the young musician as if entranced, and they looked from him to the Buddha passing before them. The singer smiled and continued to sing, "Grateful for this chance to be his student, let me praise his endless love and wisdom, the path that leads to self-contentment, and the Sangha that follows the true way of awakening." The young man continued to sing and open up a path until the Buddha and all the bhikkhus reached the palace gates. Then he bowed to the Buddha and disappeared back into the crowds as quickly as he had appeared. King Bimbisara, accompanied by 6,000 attendants and guests, came out to welcome the Buddha. The king led the Buddha and the bhikkhus to the royal courtyard where spacious tents had been set up to shade the guests from the hot sun. The Buddha was given the place of honor at the center of the courtyard. All the places for the bhikkhus had been prepared with utmost care. Once the Buddha was seated, King Bimbisara invited everyone else to be seated. The king and Uruvela Kassapa sat on either side of the Buddha. Prince Ajatasattu carried a basin of water and a towel to the Buddha for him to wash his hands and feet. Other attendants brought water and towels for all the bhikkhus. After that, the vegetarian feast was laid upon the tables. The king personally placed food into the Buddha's bowl, while Queen Videhi directed servants to serve the bhikkhus. The Buddha and the bhikkhus recited special gathas before eating. King Bimbisara and his royal guests maintained perfect silence throughout the meal. All 6,000 guests were impressed by the calm and joyous countenance of the Buddha and his bhikkhus. When the Buddha and all of the 1,250 bhikkhus were finished eating, their bowls were taken and washed and then returned. King Bimbisara turned toward the Buddha and joined his palms. Understanding the king's wishes, the Buddha began to teach the Dharma. He spoke about the five precepts as the way to create peace and happiness for one's family and all the kingdom. The first precept is, do not kill. Observing this precept nourishes compassion. All living beings fear death. As we cherish our own lives, we should cherish the lives of all other beings. Not only should we refrain from taking human life, we should strive to avoid taking the lives of other species. We must live in harmony with people, animals, and plants. If we nourish a heart of love, we can reduce suffering and create a happy life. If every citizen observes the precept not to kill, the kingdom will have peace. When the people respect each other's lives, the country will prosper and be strong, and it will be safe from invasion by other countries. Even if the kingdom possesses great military force, there will be no reason to use it. Soldiers can devote time to such worthy tasks as building roads, bridges, marketplaces, and dams. The second precept is, do not steal. No one has the right to take away the possessions that another has earned by his own labor. Attempting to seize another's goods violates this precept. Do not cheat others or use your influence and power to encroach on others' goods. Making profits from the sweat and labor of others violates this precept as well. If the citizens observe this precept, social equality will flower, and robbing and killing will quickly cease. The third precept is, avoid sexual misconduct. Sexual relations should only take place with your spouse. Observing this precept builds trust and happiness in the family and prevents unnecessary suffering to others. If you want happiness and the time and will to help your country and people, abstain from having several concubines. The fourth precept is, do not lie. Do not speak words that can create division and hatred. Your words should be in accord with the truth. Yes means yes, no means no. Words have the power to create trust and happiness, or they can create misunderstanding and hatred and even lead to murder and war. Please use words with the greatest care. The fifth precept is, do not drink alcohol or use other intoxicants. Alcohol and intoxicants rob the mind of clarity. When someone is intoxicated, he can cause untold suffering to himself, his family, and others. Observing this precept is to preserve health for the body and mind. This precept should be observed at all times. If Your Majesty and all high-ranking officials study and observe these five precepts, the kingdom will benefit greatly. Your Majesty, a king stands at the helm of his country. He must live with awareness and know all that is happening in his kingdom at all times. If you see to it that those under your charge understand and observe the five precepts, the five principles of living in peace and harmony, the country of Magadha will thrive. Overcome with joy, King Bimbisara stood and bowed before the Buddha. Queen Videhi approached the Buddha, holding the hand of her son, Prince Ajatasattu. She showed the prince how to join his palms like a lotus bud and respectfully greet the Buddha. She said, Lord Buddha, Prince Ajatasattu and 400 other children are present today. Can you teach them about the way of awareness and love? The queen bowed before the Buddha. The Buddha smiled. He reached out and clasped the young prince's hand. The queen turned around and motioned for the other children to come forward. They were the children of noble and wealthy families and were dressed in the finest of garments. Boys as well as girls wore golden bracelets around their wrists and ankles. The girls were dressed in shimmering saris of many colors. Prince Ajatasattu sat down by the feet of the Buddha. The Buddha thought of the poor country children he shared a picnic with so long ago beneath the rose apple tree in Kapilavatthu. He silently promised himself that when he returned home, he would seek out such children and share the teaching with them too. The Buddha spoke to the children before him. Children, before I was a human being, I lived as earth and stones, plants, birds, and many other animals. You too have had past lives as earth and stones, plants, birds, and animals. Perhaps you are here before me today because of some connection we shared in a past life. Perhaps in another life we brought one another joy or sorrow. Today I would like to tell you a story that took place several thousand lifetimes ago. It is the story of a heron, a crab, a plumeria tree, and many small shrimp and fish. In that life, I was the plumeria tree. Perhaps one among you was the heron, or the crab, or one of the shrimp. In this story, the heron was a wicked and deceitful creature who caused death and suffering to many others. The heron made me, the plumeria tree, suffer too. But from that suffering I learned a great lesson, and that was, if you deceive and harm others, in turn you will be deceived and harmed. I was a plumeria tree growing close to a fragrant, cool lotus pond. No fish lived in that pond. But not far from that pond was a shallow and stagnant pond, in which many fish and shrimp and one crab lived. A heron flying overhead saw the crowded situation of the fish and shrimp and devised a scheme. He landed at the edge of their pond and stood there with a long, sad face. The fish and shrimp asked him, "Mr. Heron, what are you thinking about so seriously?" "I'm thinking about your poor lot in life. Your pond is muddy and foul. You lack adequate food. I feel terrible pity for your hard lives." "Do you know of any way to help us, Mr. Heron?" asked the small creatures. "Well, if you would allow me to carry each one of you over to the lotus pond not far from here, I could release you in the cool waters there. There's plenty to eat over there." "We would like to believe you, Mr. Heron, but we have never heard that herons care anything about the lot of fish or shrimp. Perhaps you only want to trick us in order to eat us up. Why are you so suspicious? You should think of me as a kind uncle. I have no reason to deceive you. There really is a large lotus pond not far from here filled with plenty of fresh, cool water. If you don't believe me, let me fly one of you over there to see for yourself. Then I'll fly him back to tell you whether or not I'm telling the truth." The shrimp and fish discussed the matter at some length before at last agreeing to allow one of the elder fish to go with the heron. This fish was tough and bristly, his scales as hard as stones. He was a swift swimmer who could also maneuver well on sand. The heron picked him up in his beak and flew him to the lotus pond. He released the old fish into the cool waters and let him explore every nook and cranny of the pond. The pond was indeed spacious, cool, refreshing, and a plentiful source of food. When the heron returned him to the old pond, the fish reported all he had seen. Convinced of the heron's good intentions, the shrimp and fish begged him to fly them to the pond one by one. The crafty heron agreed. He picked up a fish in his beak and flew off. But this time, instead of releasing the fish into the pond, he landed near the plumeria tree. He placed the fish in a fork of the tree and ripped off its flesh with his beak. He tossed its bones by the plumeria's roots. Then he returned to transport another fish. He devoured it as well, and discarded its bones by the foot of the plumeria tree. I was that plumeria, and I witnessed all this taking place. I was enraged, but there was nothing I could do to stop the heron. A plumeria's roots are firmly anchored in the earth. There is nothing a plumeria can do but grow branches, leaves, and flowers. It cannot run anywhere. I could not call out and warn the shrimp and fish about what was really happening. I could not even stretch my branches to prevent the heron from eating the helpless creatures. I could only witness the horrible scene. Every time the heron brought a fish in its beak and began to tear at its flesh, I was filled with pain. I felt as though my sap would dry up and my branches break. Drops of moisture, like tears, collected on my bark. The heron did not notice. Over a number of days, he continued to bring the fish over to devour them. When all the fish were gone, he began to eat the shrimp. The pile of bones and shells that piled up by my roots could have filled two large baskets. I knew that as a plumeria tree, my job was to beautify the forest with my fragrant flowers. But at that moment, I suffered terribly from not being able to do anything to save the shrimp and fish. If I'd been a deer or a person, I could have done something. But anchored by my roots to the ground, I could not move. I vowed that if I were reborn as an animal or a human in a future life, I would devote all my efforts to protect the weak and helpless from the strong and powerful. When the heron had devoured all the shrimp and fish, only the crab remained. Still hungry, the heron said to the crab, "Nephew, I have carried all the fish and shrimp to the lotus pond where they now live happily. You are all alone here now. Let me take you to the new pond, too." "How will you carry me?" asked the crab. "In my beak, just as I carried all the others." "What if I slipped out and fell? My shell would shatter into 100 pieces. "Don't worry. I'll carry you with utmost care." The crab thought carefully. Perhaps the heron had kept his word and truly carried all the shrimp and fish to the lotus pond. But what if he had deceived them and eaten them all? The crab devised a plan to ensure his own safety. He said to the heron, "Uncle, I'm afraid your beak is not strong enough to hold me securely. Let me wrap my claws around your neck to hold on while you fly." The heron agreed. He waited for the crab to crawl onto his neck, and then he spread his wings and flew into the air. But instead of carrying the crab to the lotus pond, he landed by the plumeria tree. "Uncle, why don't you put me down by the lotus pond? Why did we land here instead? What heron would be so stupid as to carry a bunch of fish to a lotus pond? I am no benefactor, nephew. Do you see all those fish bones and shrimp shells at the foot of the plumeria? This is where your life will end as well." "Uncle, the fish and shrimp may have been easily fooled, but you can't trick me so easily. Take me to the lotus pond at once, or I will cut off your head with my claws." The crab began to dig his sharp claws into the heron's neck. Seized by sharp pain, the heron cried out, "Don't squeeze so hard. I'll take you to the lotus pond right this minute. I promise I won't try to eat you." The heron flew to the lotus pond where it intended to let the crab down by the water's edge. But the crab did not release its hold on the heron's neck. Thinking about all the fish and shrimp so cruelly deceived by the heron, the crab dug his claws deeper and deeper into the heron's neck until he cut right through it. The heron dropped down dead, and the crab crawled into the water. Children, at that time I was the plumeria tree. I witnessed all these events. I learned that if we treat others kindly, we will be treated kindly in return. But if we treat others cruelly, sooner or later we will suffer the same fate. I vowed that in all my future lives I would endeavor to help other beings. The children listened to the Buddha's tale with great interest. They were moved by the plumeria's pain, and they felt pity for the helpless fish and shrimp. They despised the heron's deceit and were impressed by the crab's shrewdness. Kimbimbisara stood up. He joined his palms and bowed. He said, "Master, you have shared an important lesson with young and old alike. I pray that Prince Ajatasattu remembers your words. Our kingdom is blessed to have you among us. I would now like to present you and your Sangha with a gift, if you agree." The Buddha looked at the king, waiting for him to explain. After a moment of silence, the king continued, "About 2 miles north of Rajagaha, there is a large and beautiful forest known as Venuvana, bamboo forest. It is quiet and serene, cool and refreshing. Many gentle squirrels inhabit the forest. I would like to offer you and your Sangha Venuvana as a place where you can teach and practice the way. O great teacher of compassion, please accept this gift from my heart." The Buddha reflected for a moment. It was the first time the Sangha had been offered land for a monastery. Certainly his bhikkhus did need a place to dwell during the rainy season. The Buddha breathed deeply and smiled, and he nodded his head in acceptance of the king's generous gift. King Bimbisara was overjoyed. He knew that the presence of the monastery would mean that the Buddha would spend more time in Mogoda. Among the many guests at the palace that day were a large number of Brahmana religious leaders. Many of them were not pleased with the king's decision, but they did not dare to say anything. The king asked for a golden vase of water. He poured the clear water over the Buddha's hands and solemnly announced, "Master, as the water in this vase pours over your hands, bamboo forest is transferred to you and your Sangha." This ritual concluded the offering of bamboo forest from the king to the Buddha. The ceremonial feast came to an end, and the Buddha and his 1,250 bhikkhus departed from the palace. Chapter 31. I Will Return in the Spring. The very next day, the Buddha visited Bamboo Forest with several of his senior students. It was an ideal location for the Sangha, with nearly 100 acres of healthy bamboo groves. Many kinds of bamboo grew there. At the center of the forest, Kalandaka Lake would be a perfect place for the bhikkhus to bathe, wash their robes, and do walking meditation along the shore. Because the bamboo was so plentiful, it would be easy to build small huts for the older monks to live in. The Buddha's senior students, including Kondana, Kassapa, and Sariputta, were all delighted with Bamboo Forest. They began planning at once how to best organize a monastery there. The Buddha said, "The monsoon season is not a good time for travel. The bhikkhus need a place to study and practice together during the rains. Having a place like this will help the community avoid illness from exposure to the elements, and also avoid stepping on the many worms and insects that are washed up on the ground during the rainy season. From now on, I would like the bhikkhus to return to a common place at the beginning of every rainy season. We can ask lay disciples of the area to bring food offerings during the 3 months of retreat. The lay disciples will also benefit from the teachings offered by the bhikkhus." Thus, the tradition of the rainy season retreat began. Under Moggallana's supervision, the younger bhikkhus built huts from bamboo, thatch, and pounded earth for the Buddha and the older bhikkhus. The Buddha's hut, though small, was quite lovely. Behind it grew a thicket of golden bamboo, and to one side grew a thicket of taller green bamboo, which provided cool shade. Bhikkhu Nagasamala built a low wooden platform for the Buddha to sleep on. He also placed a large earthenware vessel for washing behind the Buddha's hut. Nagasamala was a young bhikkhu who had been Uruvela Kassapa's disciple. He was asked by Kassapa to serve as an attendant to the Buddha when the Sangha moved to Bamboo Forest. Sariputta arranged with a lay disciple from the capital to have a large bell donated to Bamboo Forest Monastery. He hung it from the branch of an ancient tree near Kalandaka Lake. The bell was used to announce times for study and meditation, and became a special part of the practice of mindfulness. The Buddha taught his bhikkhus to pause and observe their breath whenever they heard the bell ring. Lay disciples assisted in many ways. Kassapa explained to them about the retreat season. "This retreat season will afford all the bhikkhus an opportunity to practice the way of liberation directly under the guidance of the Buddha. They will have time for more intensive study and practice. At the same time, they will avoid accidentally crushing worms and insects on the ground during the rainy season. You can assist the Sangha during these 3 months of retreat by bringing food offerings. If possible, please try to coordinate your efforts to assure that there is the right amount of food each day, neither too much nor too little. Even the poorest of the poor, those who can offer only a chapati or two, will be invited to stay and listen to the Buddha or one of the senior students give a discourse on the Dharma each day. The retreat season will benefit bhikkhus and lay disciples alike." Kassapa proved to be as talented at organizing the laity as he was at organizing the bhikkhus. He met with lay sponsors of the monastery and helped them organize the food offerings and other forms of assistance. He assured that every bhikkhu received a robe, begging bowl, meditation cushion, towel, and water filter for personal use. The first day of the retreat arrived, and the Sangha followed the schedule that had been carefully thought out by the Buddha and his senior students. The wake-up bell rang at 4 in the morning. After washing up, the bhikkhus did walking meditation on their own. They continued to alternate sessions of sitting and walking meditation until the sun peeked over the tops of the bamboos. Normally, that was the time to go begging, but since during the retreat food was brought to them by the laity, the bhikkhus had some extra time to meet with their individual teachers to study the Dharma in greater depth and to discuss any difficulties they were having in their practice. Bhikkhus who served as teachers were selected according to the depth of progress they had made on the path. Elders such as Kondana, Asaji, Kassapa, Sariputta, Moggallana, Vappa, and Mahanama each guided 50 or 60 younger bhikkhus. Other teachers were given responsibility for 10 to 30 students. Every new bhikkhu was assigned a personal teacher who served as his elder brother in the practice. Kassapa and Sariputta personally organized the system. Shortly before midday, the bhikkhus gathered by the lake and stood in lines holding their begging bowls. Food was divided and shared equally. When everyone had been served, they all sat on the grassy shores and ate in silence. When the meal was completed and the bowls washed, everyone turned toward the Buddha. On some days he directed his teaching to the bhikkhus, but in a way that was also helpful to the laity. On other days he directed his teaching to the laity, but in a way that also benefited the bhikkhus. Sometimes his teaching was addressed especially to the children present. In those Dharma talks, he often told past life tales. Sometimes one of the Buddha's senior students gave the Dharma talk in his place. The Buddha would sit and listen serenely, offering words of encouragement when he saw that the Dharma was expressed in a correct and clear manner. After the Dharma talks, the lay disciples would return home, and the bhikkhus would rest until the afternoon bell announced the time to resume sitting and walking meditation. The bhikkhus practiced until midnight before retiring. The Buddha sat in meditation far into the night. He liked to place his bamboo platform outside his hut and sit on it, enjoying the cool night air, especially on nights with the moon. Before dawn, he liked to do walking meditation around the lake. Ever joyous, peaceful, and relaxed, the Buddha did not require as much sleep as the younger bhikkhus. Kassapa sat in meditation far into the night also. King Bimbisara visited Bamboo Forest faithfully. He did not bring great numbers of guests as he had the time he visited Palm Forest. Sometimes he was accompanied by Queen Videhi and Prince Ajatasattu. Often he came alone. He would leave his carriage at the edge of the forest and walk on his own to the Buddha's hut. One day, after seeing the bhikkhus listening to the Dharma talk in the rain, he asked the Buddha's permission to build a large Dharma hall where the bhikkhus could both eat and listen to the teaching without being drenched by the rain. The Buddha consented, and work on the hall began right away. It was large enough to shelter more than 1,000 bhikkhus and 1,000 lay disciples. The Dharma hall was a most helpful addition to the monastery. The Buddha and the king often sat together on the bamboo platform while carrying on conversations. Then Nagasamala built some simple bamboo chairs to enable the Buddha to receive guests more easily. One day, as the Buddha and the king sat on two of these chairs, the king confided, "I have another son that you have not yet met. I would like very much for you to meet him and his mother. He is not the child of Queen Videhi. His mother's name is Ambapali, and his name is Jivaka. He will soon be 16 years old. Ambapali lives in Vesali, north of the city of Pataliputta. She does not like the confined life of the palace, and she is not concerned about titles or prestige. She treasures only her own freedom. I have provided them with several means of support, including a beautiful mango grove. Jivaka is a diligent and intelligent boy who is not at all interested in military or political affairs. He is living near the capital pursuing medical studies. I love them deeply, and hope you will love them too. O compassionate one, if you would agree to meet Jivaka and his mother, I will ask them to come to Bamboo Forest in the near future." The Buddha quietly smiled in agreement. The king joined his palms and departed, his heart filled with gratitude. During that same period, Bamboo Forest Monastery received two very special guests who had come all the way from Kapilavatthu, the Buddha's home. They were the Buddha's old friend, Kaludai, and Channa, who had driven the Buddha's carriage. Their presence imparted a special warmth to the monastery. The Buddha had been absent for more than 7 years, and he was anxious to hear news of home. He asked Kaludai about the king and queen, Yasodhara, Nanda, Sundari Nanda, his friends, and of course his son Rahula. Though Kaludai was still hale and hearty, his face bore the lines of age. Channa looked older too. The Buddha spoke with him for a long time as they sat outside his hut. He learned that Kaludai now held considerable rank at court and was one of King Suddhodana's most trusted advisors. News that the Buddha had attained the way and was teaching in Mogoda had reached Kapilavatthu 2 months previously. Everyone rejoiced at the news, especially the king and queen and Gopa. The king, much to Kaludai's pleasure, had sent Kaludai to invite the Buddha to return home. He took 3 days to prepare for the journey, unable to sleep at night for sheer excitement. Yasodhara suggested he take Channa along. Channa was so happy when Kaludai agreed that he openly wept. It took the two men nearly a month to reach Bamboo Forest Monastery. According to Kaludai, the king's physical health had declined in recent years, though he was still quite alert mentally. The king had several talented advisers to help him run the country. Gotami was as robust as ever. Prince Nanda was now a young man and engaged to a young noblewoman named Kalyani. Nanda was very handsome and liked to dress in fine clothes, but the king was concerned that Nanda still lacked a certain stability and maturity. Sundari Nanda, the Buddha's sister, was now a beautiful and graceful young woman. As for Yasodhara, she had given up wearing all jewelry the day the Buddha departed. She dressed very simply and had sold all her precious possessions in order to give the money to the poor. When she learned that the Buddha ate no more than one meal a day, she began to do the same. She had continued her relief work with the active support of Queen Gotami. Rahula was now a healthy and handsome boy of 7. His black eyes flashed with intelligence and determination. His grandparents dearly cherished him, just as they had cherished Siddhartha as a boy. Channa confirmed all that Kaludai told the Buddha. The Buddha's heart was warmed by all the news of home. Finally, Kaludai asked the Buddha when he might return to Kapilavatthu. The Buddha said, "I will return after the rainy season. I do not want to leave the young bhikkhus here until they are more firmly anchored in their practice. After this period of retreat, I will feel more at ease about leaving them." "But Kaludai, Channa, why don't you remain here yourselves for a month or so to taste this life? That will still allow you plenty of time to return to Kapilavatthu and inform the king that I will be back after monsoon season." Kaludai and Channa were delighted to remain as guests at Bamboo Forest Monastery. They made friends with many of the bhikkhus and were able to taste the joyous and peaceful life of one who leaves home to follow the way. They learned how practicing the way of awareness in daily life could nourish the mind and heart. Kaludai spent much time at the Buddha's side and observed him carefully. He was deeply moved by the Buddha's wondrous ease. It was clear that the Buddha had attained a state in which he no longer chased after any desire. The Buddha was like a fish swimming freely, or a cloud floating peacefully in the sky. He dwelled completely in the present moment. The Buddha's eyes and smile were evidence of the wonderful liberation his spirit enjoyed. Nothing in this world bound him, yet no one else possessed so great an understanding and love for others as he did. Kaludai saw that his old friend had left him far behind on the spiritual path. Suddenly, Kaludai found himself longing for the serene, unfettered life of a bhikkhu. He felt ready to abandon all rank, wealth, and prestige, and all the worries and anxieties that accompanied such a life. After spending just 7 days at Bamboo Forest, he confided his wish to be ordained as a bhikkhu to the Buddha. The Buddha looked somewhat surprised, but then he smiled and nodded his head in acceptance. Channa felt the same desire to become a bhikkhu, but aware of his duty to the royal family, he reflected that he should not become a bhikkhu without first asking Yasodhara's leave. He resolved to wait until the Buddha returned to Kapilavatthu before making his request.